Disasters are a reality of life in the Pacific, but so is the strength and resilience of its people. Pacific Prepared shares first-hand stories from communities on the ground, drawing on tradition, culture, and collective wisdom to stay safe and support one another in times of disaster. Pacific Prepared explores how communities are adapting and protecting what matters most. Search up ABC Pacific Prepared to listen online or find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is an ABC podcast.
Hi, I'm Scott Whitey, and this is Polytalk. In our last episode, we followed one Marshallese teenager, Russell Langreen, from high school graduation in California to the front lines of Operation Desert Storm. Russell wore the uniform, trained in Guantanamo Bay, walked through the minefields in Kuwait, and carried live rounds and grenades into America's war.
And I was there, sitting in the desert thinking, what the heck am I doing here? I'm not cut out for this. I didn't join up to shoot somebody. I joined up for the GI Bill. It makes you grow up quickly.
But when he went home to the Marshall Islands, he discovered for veterans like him, there was no veteran affairs clinic, no trauma counselor, and no way to treat PTSD or chronic health issues without leaving his own country.
PTSD for islanders, soldiers or military veterans are really bad. And they have absolutely no help. No help or no counseling service, nothing that we can access that could help us.
Under the Compact of Free Association, or COFA, the Marshall Islands, the Federated States of Micronesia, and Palau gained political independence and the right for their citizens to live, work, study, and serve in the United States.
So these compacts granted the U.S. strategic control over these nations' security and defense in exchange for economic and assistance and benefits for their citizens.
In return, Washington kept exclusive control over defense, military access across a huge stretch of the Pacific, and poured billions of dollars into these economies in the form of grants, trust funds, and aid projects. For the Marshall Islands, the latest round of negotiations in 2023 promised more than $2 billion over 20 years. But as we heard in part one, that deal has a cost. For Russell, it meant having to live in Salem, Oregon, because he can't access Veterans Affairs care in Majuro.
I want to go back, but now I'm older, I got medical issues. Can't get it treated back there. Over here in Salem, I have a VA clinic that I can go to. They take care of you.
For Marshallese families in places like Springdale, Arkansas, the unofficial Marshallese capital in the U.S., they left their home looking for better work and health care in America, only to become reliant on their former colonizer.
I think one word to describe it is dependency. You know, we were hoping to become self-sufficient under the Compact of Free Association, but that has become, we've become more dependent on the United States the last almost 40 years now.
And it's in the communities who still live with the legacy of the 67 U.S. nuclear test in the Marshall Islands, a shattered food system, chronic illness, and displaced families who cannot return to the ancestral atolls for thousands of years.
I always saw the compact as a cheap price to pay for U.S. nuclear testing in the Marshall Islands. We need adequate victims' assistance and environmental remediation from the United States to address these ongoing issues that the Marshall Islands alone cannot address.
The Compact of Free Association has poured billions of dollars into the Marshall Islands. But it's also tied Marshallese independence to American power, American funding cycles, and American decisions about who gets care and who doesn't.
The compact, I argue, reveals how colonialism changes and morphs over time. Empires use different strategies depending on what's effective or politically palatable or undesirable in certain moments, yet retains key features, namely dominance and restrictions on national sovereignty.
Today, in part two of The Cost of COFA, we're putting questions directly to the Marshall Islands government. What has this compact really delivered for Marshallese veterans, for the diaspora, and for survivors of nuclear testing? What hasn't been honored? And what is the government fighting for now as a new generation of COFA agreements come into force? In this episode, you'll hear from Marshall Islands Foreign Affairs Minister Kalani Kaneko, who spoke to our producer Jordan Fennell about the promise of COFA, the failures in how it's been implemented, and what justice would actually look like for his people. Let's go to their conversation.
Minister, you are a veteran of the US military. Can you take me back to 1995 when you first signed up? Why did you decide to join the Army?
Well, Jordan, right after high school, I attended college, and it was not easy because I had to pay tuition. At the time, RMI citizens were not eligible for Pell Grant or any other scholarship that is presented to U.S. citizens at the time. I was living in Hawaii, and I needed scholarship or tuition funds to continue on with my education. That forced me into the U.S. military. And at first, I thought I was going to enlist and do the bare minimum of 4 years and get out of the military and continue my education. But as soon as I entered the U.S. Army, I figured out that it was a place that I belong. I started off as an infantryman for the first couple of years, and I re-enlisted, keep re-enlisting because I saw that U.S. Armed Forces just don't provide, you know, place a roof over our head and food on the table, but provide more than what I was looking for, which was discipline and, you know, being part of the strongest army in the world. It was something big for me.
Now, you served for 20 years from 1995 until 2015, where you then retired. What was that transition and journey like between retiring from the U.S. Army to entering politics for Marshall Islands?
The minimum requirement years to be considered retired in the U.S. military is 20 years. So I decided, I'm still young. I was about 39 year old, and I thought, okay, start a new career. My major in college is marketing and business management. So I decided I'm going to try work for Nike as a marketing director. After my retirement date, I submit my application. But at the same time, I had two senators, current senators at the time, and they're still senators now. They came out to my retirement ceremony in Fort Lewis, Washington. I thought they were just there to celebrate my retirement and witness my retirement ceremony, retirement from the U.S. Army. But at the same time, they were recruiting. They recruited me, convinced me to come back and work for the people. At first, I thought, let's give it a shot. I wasn't, it's hard to believe. I left when I was very young. I believe I was 13 or 14 years old when I left and went to school in the States. So I thought the people don't know me. I don't think I'll win, but why not? Let's give it a shot. And that's what really convinced me to run for office. But politics was never came across my mind, except for those two senators from Majuro that came out and recruited me from the States.
And so when you did return to Marshall Islands, tell me a little bit about how you found the experience of returning as a veteran and then also seeing other veterans returning as well, and about the lack of services, especially when it comes to medical care. What was that experience for you going back to RMI and seeing how that played out for veterans?
Before I returned home after my retirement, I was doing recruiting. I recruited for the U.S. Army, so I was going back and forth between states and RMI, Republic of the Marshall Islands. So I kind of noticed that the healthcare system here is, you know, not the best for the U.S. military veterans. It doesn't exist. They don't give care to our veterans. And as a recruiter, part of my recruitment was talking about veterans' benefit after serving in the U.S. military. That's what really shined the light at what is needed here, not just in the Marshall Islands, but also in FSM, Federated States of Micronesia, and also Republic of Palau. It's very frustrating to see our veterans not getting the care that they deserve, especially, you know, being promised that they'll be taken care of right after serving in the U.S. military. Congress is very open and they are very keen in to help our veterans. That's the implementation piece. It's taking too long. I think they could have done faster. I'm not trying to find an excuse to give VA a leeway, but I think they can, if they put more efforts into it, even though the veterans in the COFA nations are not a big and a large number, but every veterans matter.
The Compact of Free Association, known as COFA, came into effect in 1986, and it's been 40 years that the Marshallese have been signing up to fight and have then become veterans. But over those 40 years, no veteran services have been delivered to Marshall Islands. So what is happening right now, four decades on?
Matter of fact, there is lots of meetings taking place. Right now, we have two committees, two different committees. One is the advisory committee to the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, which was established by Congress through legislation. And the second committee is COFA VA, which is was created by Veterans Affairs through the previous administration to figure out how to implement, who to partner with to implement the legislation that requires VA to provide care for veterans in the in Micronesia. So the debt and the bureaucracy in the system is what slows down the implementation of these current legislation. But, we see throughout the 10 years that I've started working on since 2016, I see a lot of moving pieces, but it's all meetings. It's all words. We're yet to get the, I call it the low-hanging fruits.
And what are the low-hanging fruits from your perspective?
For example, one is being the prescribed medication, which was prescribed by the Veterans Affairs doctors to our veterans that are living here. They could have mail it, which they, like they do in the States. They mail the medication from VA pharmacy straight to veterans' homes through USPS or US Postal Services. We have postal services here, and our postal services serve hand in hand or parallel with the USPS. And we could have get our medication through the mail. And until now, we're still sitting duck waiting for our medications to arrive through USPS. It is very frustrating for our veterans, even myself, to have VA send my medication to my children in the United States for them to forward it to me. That is the most simplest issue to address, is having VA to directly mail my medication from the United States veterans hospitals directly to my post office box here in the RMI. I don't see what's so hard about this. And I hope that this will take place as soon as possible. Our veterans need those medication while we work on other complex and complicated issues.
Is it a bad deal that what the RMI veterans have gotten, you know, they go and they serve, and then if they want to go home to RMI, they can't access anything? Is it just a bad deal for those who sign up to the U.S. military?
Oh, I wouldn't say a bad deal, because while serving in the U.S. military, you gain a lot. You gain so much, not just benefit and salary, but you gain so much through work experience, training, and even, you know, values. You gain military values through your service time. The short part is the veterans care, which is it's not a bad deal, because you get to choose. If I decide to live in Oregon, then I still receive veterans care in Oregon, just like everybody else. But the short piece is, if the U.S. military is recruiting in the COFA nations, then they should provide veterans care here in the COFA nations to allow our veterans to choose if they want to come home where they were recruited from.
If Marshallese veterans need to go to America for care, has COFA just created an ongoing dependency on the United States?
Yes, I've seen a lot of my friends and colleagues and comrades who tried to return home and find a job here in the Marshall Islands, but they have some health issues that they need medical attention, and it's not even available here in the Marshall Islands, so they decided to live and end up staying. They have no choice but to stay in the States to get those veterans healthcare benefits. So yes, it does create or force some of our veterans to stay in the States instead of returning home.
In 2024, the U.S. Congress authorized Veterans Affairs Services in COFA nations. But as of now, there's still no permanent clinic, no mental health support or any services available. So where do things stand at the moment on that?
What I can tell you is what I know. I have not seen any movement as far as implementing or even trying to set up a clinic or telehealth. There's a lot of talks, like I said. There's a lot of meetings, but we haven't seen any movement to establish a written agreement or even getting a land lease for a piece of land to build a clinic. There's no movement, you know. That's what I know.
Marshallese veterans have expressed frustration with the little progress that has been made over the years. Do you have a message for Marshallese veterans?
I really don't have a message for them, because I know that they are very frustrated. They have heard almost any scenarios, any courses of action that might take place. It is a matter of implementation. So I have no message for them, but I do have a message to the U.S. Veterans Affairs and the U.S. Congress that our veterans in the COFA nations are yet to see tangible evidence of what, you know, thousands of hours of meetings throughout the last almost 10 years now. So far, we've lost three of our veterans through suicide here in the Marshall Islands. Just Marshall Islands alone. Just three. Three, compared to other places, might be small. But every life counts. And the longer we wait, I wonder how many more lives we will lose just because we're waiting on somebody to implement the health benefits or health care benefits to our veterans in the COFA nations.
You mentioned there you've lost three veterans to suicide. From your perspective, what is it like for veterans when they return home to Marshall Islands? And what are you seeing on the ground?
Well, they're going through a lot. They are going through a lot. So the individual veterans are going through a lot of issues, health issues, and their families end up carrying that burden along with them. So it does weigh a lot on our veterans here and their families. I really hope that we can ratify the issue now rather than wait another year or another decade, because we'll continue to lose our veterans. But we really hope that something will come out and will be implemented this time.
And what gives you hope that services will be implemented this time around?
The reason why our hope is high, last Donald Trump's administration,
he sent the Secretary of Veterans Affairs to the Marshall Islands. So that's what really shined the light on Veterans Affairs, veterans issues here. And I hope that his new administration will continue on with that legacy from the last Secretary of Veterans Affairs visit to the Republic of the Marshall Islands to finally, once and for all, provide what we've been, you know, discussing through meetings from the last 10 plus years.
Minister, when we talk about COFA, people often focus on financial assistance. But what do you want people to understand about the sacrifices that Marshall Islands has made in this partnership with the US, especially around the US base in Marshall Islands and the nuclear testing legacy?
Jordan, I truly believe that it's important for people to understand the uniqueness about the sacrifices and the partnership that COFA nations, especially RMI, by hosting the Kwajalein-based and also throughout the missile testings, the nuclear testings here in the RMI, I believe is very important for people to fully understand the sacrifices our people went through. And we don't just depending on United States for assistance. But we have to look for moral obligations that they owe to our people who are still displaced. We still have vast number of people that are scattered, not just in the RMI, but they also have moved to the United States and elsewhere to find a place to call home because they cannot return to their homeland due to radiation. They won't return to their homeland for another thousand of years.
When the first original COFA agreement was signed in 1986 and the negotiations came about, that was when there was quite limited information about the nuclear testing program and the impact that it had. Obviously, now we do know much more about the scale of the harm that came from that. And Marshallese that I've spoken to, many say that there haven't been any sort of comprehensive redress for Marshallese. They say they haven't seen the full documents of what's happened with the nuclear legacy and that they haven't seen adequate victims' assistance. Why do you think that has not yet been achieved for the Marshallese? And what is your government doing at the moment to try and push that forward?
Jordan, we're doing what we can. We have consulted with our with the U.S. Embassy here. We've consulted through our RMI Embassy in Washington, D.C. We have consulted directly with State Department and Department of Energy on issues and ongoing issues of how we address the nuclear legacy. There is many things we're trying to do, but we always run into, you know, roadblocks. As of now, U.S. doesn't open their doors to, you know, just entertain what has been learned. In 1986, there was only a portion of the information needed now to come up with actual compensation to these people based on what really took place. Now that a lot of information or, you know, quite a amount of information that was released to the RMI government, we see more and more unaddressed or unmet needs that needs to be addressed by U.S. Congress.
So you feel that the U.S. has not allowed for direct conversation or direct interaction on the nuclear redress issue?
Yes. When we negotiated Compact 3, we were promised that we would revisit nuclear legacy, but we cannot have nuclear legacy or negotiate nuclear legacy in conjunction with the Compact 3. We were supposed to talk in parallel with our compact, and that's not what's happening now. We were promised one thing, and until today, it's been almost 3 years since the Compact 3 was signed, and we haven't speak nuclear with the U.S. government.
And how do you and the Marshall Islands government feel about this?
It's an ongoing frustration. We've been promised one thing, as I said. We negotiated our people, founding fathers, negotiated in good faith, hoping and knowing at the time that U.S. would address this issue when the time comes. And when we cannot even talk about this subject with the United States, is very frustrating. Very, very, very frustrating for us, especially for these people who continue to lose their lives, family members losing their lives because of cancer. We have the highest rate of cancer in the world.
Minister, can you trust the United States?
Well, that's a really big question. I think I've been in this post for almost 2 years now. That's the question I ask myself. The reason why I ask myself, the people are asking me that same question. I've been asked that question more than 100 times since I've been Minister of Foreign Affairs. I've been asked that question. And I give the benefit of the doubt to the leaders of the United States government to answer that question for us. As I said, bureaucracy through legality, you know, all these lawyers interpreting the agreement might be different. But leaders in government can find, if they have the will to help our people, they will find the will and they will find a way to address the issue. So, Jordan, that's a really good question. And I'll leave it to the United States government to answer it through actions and not just words.
Politok has put detailed questions to the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. In response to the question, why has the VA failed to establish any on-island healthcare services for Marshallese veterans, despite the legislation passed in 2024, they said a law passed in 2024, the Consolidated Appropriations Act, gave Veterans Affairs the option to provide direct medical care to veterans in Marshall Islands, Palau, and FSM, but it did not provide funding for that care. It went on to say it provides health care to the veterans who are eligible to access the Foreign Medical Program in COFA states, and that Veterans Affairs continues to work with the U.S. Congress to consider options for improved care for all veterans. Politok has also put detailed questions about Minister Kalani Kaneko's claims to the U.S. Embassy in Majuro. In response, the United States says it acknowledges the negative effects of its nuclear testing program in the Marshall Islands between 1946 and 1958, and says it has accepted and acted on its responsibility. The embassy pointed to the Compact of Free Association and the Section 177 agreement, saying they constitute a full settlement of all claims related to nuclear testing. It said the U.S. has provided more than $600 million to affected communities, more than $1 billion in today's terms, through compensation, resettlement, rehabilitation, and healthcare. On calls to revisit compensation, the United States says its position has not changed, that the settlement covers all claims past, present, and future. Politok is hosted by me, Scott Wyde. Our producer is Kuntamari Crofts. Our supervising producer is Jordan Fennell. And our executive producer is Faleanga Fulu, Inga Stunzner.